Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 136 of the podcast, everybody, with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel. Now, this episode of the podcast turned into a bit of a ranty one. I don't think we planned it that way, but it did, because we're talking about driving etiquette, driving standards, lane discipline on the motorway, all that sort of stuff, you know, the things that wind us up on the road. But I suspect it's the kind of episode that will resonate with a lot of you. So we'll get straight into it. Let us know what you think. Do you think generally that driving standards have become worse over recent years?
Yeah, I do. Not dramatically so, but, you know, I'm very old and I've been, I've been cheesed off with the behaviour of other road users for 40 bloody years. Blimey, I've only just realised.
As long as you've been a road user, I suppose.
As long as I've been a road user, yeah. But have they got worse? I think my perception of them has got worse, but that's probably what happens when you get to sort of advanced middle age and you turn into a sort of curmudgeonly old scroat, and you know these things just matter more to you, because I suspect also 40 years ago I was probably the one causing most of the problems rather than observing them and getting cheesed off by them. But my perception is that they are getting worse. The only thing that tends to I'll say two things. Well, firstly is that they got a lot worse when COVID hit, because the roads were much less busy. And there's nothing which is more likely to get people to behave badly than giving them the space in which to do so. If you're completely gridlocked, there's very little people can do. I guess when they were completely empty, then there was no need to. And also, but then the price of fuel went through the roof and everyone is now driving really slowly because they can't afford to fill their cars. So actually, I'd say at the moment, they're probably getting a bit better. But it sort of ebbs and flows. But generally, I would say the progression is towards, as in society. I don't want to sound profound about this, but I think we just live in a less considerate, more selfish era. More's the pity. But then again, I suspect there's never been a generation of person who doesn't feel that about, you know, the way things are today.
Well, of course, yeah, we're all doomed to that same fate, aren't we, to believe things are worse now than they used to be. But I suppose a big part of the topic here is consideration for other road users, isn't it? And you talk about a slightly more selfish society. And if consideration for other road users is dropping away, then the road's just going to become a terrible place to be. Don't we all just need to get along?
Well, we do, but it's difficult because, you know, you have people out there with such varying driving standards. Yeah. You know, there are people who spend their lives on the roads, and actually, I think people who do that usually tend to be pretty good drivers. And then you've got people who need to drive, but do so very occasionally. And maybe quite scared drivers or timid drivers, or they might be quite old. There's the whole bicycle thing, which has been increasingly, yeah, particularly around where I live, that requires a whole new level of discipline and observation and self-control. And what I wish, I'm not going to get into the cycling thing here, because I did it once before and said something which some cycling community got the wrong end of in a blog I wrote for Motorsport. And they crashed the website. The only way you could comment on the story that I wrote was by joining up, which is free to join, the Motorsport website. And so many people tried to join the website just so that they could call me every name under the sun. It crashed the website. So I'm not going to get into the, I believe that, you know, cyclists are entitled to use the road as anybody else. But what I do wish is that motorists and cyclists could reach a better accommodation with each other. And I think that there is, you know, there is guilt on both sides. And I think if motorists tried to understand the needs and the requirements of cyclists and vice versa,
yeah,
the world would be a much better place. But and you know that it can, because actually if you go to places where, you know, cycling has been a way of life for generations, like France or Italy, everybody gets on perfectly well. And it just seems to happen. And, you know, you never see these terrible sort of contretemps or queues of traffic, you know, behind a peloton of cyclists, because, you know, everybody understands that everybody else has got to get where they're going whenever it is they're going to get there. And people make allowances. But it just seems to be, in this country, just something which is in a process of being developed at the moment. And that sort of innate understanding between the two road users hasn't been reached yet. So, you know, I'm not apportioning blame to either side at all, because I think probably both sides are equally to blame. But
Yeah, well, it comes down to empathy and understanding again, doesn't it? And I think if we all use the road, even just for a month, you know, if all drivers got on a bike for a month and all cyclists got in the cars and whoever else got on a motorcycle, you know, if we had just a better understanding of yeah, exactly. If we all understood how other road users are vulnerable or frustrated or whatever, we understand one another. We just make allowances, and it's when we become tribal about it and absolutely adamant that everyone else is in the wrong, that's when it becomes combative. And that, you know, the road should not be a place of combat. It just seems
because, you know, when you have a lump of metal weighing considerably more than a ton coming up against, you know, a rider on a bicycle, you know, the consequences are obvious. I used to cycle a lot when I was young, and I've been thinking about taking it up again. And one of the reasons I don't is the big main road that sort of goes up past my house is a very, very popular cycling route. And I've looked at it, and I'd just be scared. Because, you know, it goes up and down the Wye Valley, and you're in and out of shadow, and it's a main road. People go fast down there in their cars. There are lots of blind brows. And lots of times when you're coming, you know, in and out of trees, so you go from light to shade to light to shade. And, you know, I guess I will have to do it, and I will just be high-vised. You know, I'll be like this massive yellow beacon going up and down the road. But I'll still be scared, and I don't want to indulge in a recreational activity and be scared while I'm doing it. It's just, maybe I'm just very timid, but, you know, and you get, you know, vast numbers, particularly in the summer, of cyclists going up and down this road, having a great time. And I just think, would I really want to do that?
I feel vulnerable on the road on a bicycle. I don't do it much, but anytime I do, I feel vulnerable. Also, in Bristol, we have those electric scooters, which are actually they're a great way for nipping around town. I do use them sometimes.
Do you use them?
Yeah, they're brilliant for sort of shorter journeys. Normally it's fine, but you do feel vulnerable again. And you just think, if someone in their car or on a van or a truck isn't paying attention, it's not going to take much. It's not going to take a huge error of judgment for the consequences to be really vast. And I think once you understand that some people genuinely are vulnerable on the road, it gives you a greater understanding of their needs.
And that's the thing. You don't actually need someone to be driving like an arse or being inconsiderate. You just need, I don't know, some, you know, to be going down a street, you know, with parked cars, or someone just opens a door.
Yeah, because they haven't checked.
Or they've checked, but probably not as thoroughly as they should have done. And, you know, the terrible things happen. And it's, you know, I got driven into last week. Okay, I had an accident last week. I mean, it was completely inconsequential, 98% of it polished up. But nevertheless, I was going down a two-lane road, so two lanes going in the same direction. I was in a large black Nissan, and a bloke in a van just moved into the lane I was occupying at the time. So the front of his van hit the back of the Nissan, and as I say, the damage wasn't great. But you know, if you can fail to see a Nissan Ariya, which he did, then you know that's what makes me worried about some poor man or woman on a bicycle. But anyway, that's not really what we're here to talk about, is it?
Well, let me give you something that really annoys me on the road.
Go on.
And this is a very recent thing. This is... I don't particularly mean to attack any individual group, but this is delivery riders on their scooters and mopeds with their phones in front of them. They might be Deliveroo or Uber Eats or whatever. But they're tapping away on their screens as they're riding along. I see it. Sometimes I see them holding their phones while riding along, scrolling away, checking on their orders or whatever. But they're literally using their phones as they ride along. Surely those apps should just lock out when the vehicle's in motion. So they just display the map and the routes. But
which technologically is a very easy thing to do.
It's extremely easy to do.
And so I think the question that arises from that is, what responsibility lies on the company? Because I presume they're doing it not because they're bored or because, you know, that's kind of like a fun thing, but I presume they're doing it because they're on some performance-related package. And, you know, if you have to stop at the side of the road to, you know, to check off the delivery you've just made and find out where the next collection is going to be, that's all time, isn't it? So it's all effectively money. So the terms of your employment, and of course they'll be in the small print saying you must drive safely, don't do this, don't do that. But the very fact that they allow it, and the very fact that these people who get paid, probably a minimum wage, just realise that if they can take, and the problem is, until it goes wrong, it seems like such a simple, obvious thing to do, and it's only when it's suddenly you go from just bimbling along, not paying quite as much attention to utter catastrophe in a quarter of a second. I think you're absolutely right. I think, of course, it must happen. And to me, it's, of course, it's the fault of the person that's doing it. But there is a greater responsibility on behalf of the people who employ them, don't pay them very much. And if not actively, if not overtly, then certainly actually put these pressures on these people to, to behave the way that they do.
No question about it. I know you've got a list.
Well, I mean, I'm looking down the list and there is, there's so much obvious stuff. We're getting towards the winter now, aren't we? And, increasingly you see people, fog lights. Do fog lights really wind you up when there's no fog about?
Well, they do, I also see people driving with their fog lights and side lights on. I think because they think it looks cool. That's been happening for years. Surely they can't see a thing. And it does look quite striking when you've got two low down fog lights and just side lights on. But it's dark.
Goodness,
you need your headlights. That's what they're for.
Yeah. No, what really winds me up is when it's raining a bit, people put their fog lights on.
Yeah.
What they appear not to realise is once they do that, you can't see their brake lights.
Yeah.
Good so point. if they suddenly have to stop, you're not going to see it because those fog lights are so bright. And it's obviously it's always at the worst when you've just come out of a bank of fog and there's no fog around and everybody just forgets to turn their. And I don't know what you do about that because it's an understandable error to make, but I don't know.
This is the start of the Alpha Papa. Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge film, isn't it? Where he's driving along, shouting at someone, "Your fog lights are on. It's not foggy. We've literally descended into Partridge."
I have become Alan. It's been a lifelong ambition of mine. I'm finally getting there. Do you think, as someone who's lucky enough to drive in all sorts of different places, do you think that driving standards in the UK are worse than those you find abroad? Or are there particularly countries where you go to and there's just terrible driving?
If we're just talking Europe, because if you go to, I don't know, Sri Lanka or somewhere, the driving is outrageous.
It's hilarious.
But Europe. So particularly motorways. I mean, that's the obvious one, isn't it? And it doesn't help that our motorways are stacked. They are so busy. When you get on an auto route in France, it's a dream. You know, the country's twice the size at least. Similar, slightly smaller population, so the roads are much quieter. But they just flow, unless you're near one of the big cities.
Yeah, but you also have to pay for them, which is another reason.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But no, there's no question that particularly lane discipline on our motorways is appalling.
You can see them coming, can't you? Do you subscribe to the notion that, I don't know, you know, the most aggressive drivers tend to drive BMWs, or do you think it's a nice kind of across the board thing?
Oh God, we're going to upset some people, aren't we?
I say it because I've heard it so many times, and I have seen a lot of very aggressively driven BMWs as well. But I've seen an enormous number of aggressively driven Range Rovers as well, and Audis. And probably, if I think about it, probably almost, I'm not sure I've seen very many aggressively driven Kia Picantos, but but you can always see them, can't you? It's, you know, if you drive for long enough, and this is something I've been trying to teach my daughters who, you know, who have both been driving for a little bit now, but it's something you can't learn in a test. That just, that sort of innate instinctive understanding of your environment and what is going on around you. And you will just suddenly, without looking for it, you will just be aware that there's an idiot 100 yards behind you. And I say he because it's always a he. He's coming your way. Because you can just see that, in your peripheral, you can see all the traffic seems to be moving one direction apart from one little bit of it, which is going from left to right to left to right. Yeah. And you can see some moron carving his way through the traffic. if he tries to do that to you, and he's steaming up your inside, would you just sort of close the gap a little bit so he couldn't just dive? Would you think, okay, I'm not going to reward that behaviour by indulging him and letting him get in? Or do you actually think, road safety is the far more important criteria, and me driving too close to the car in front to stop him getting in that gap isn't the right thing to do?
I'm ashamed to say I do sometimes close that gap, but it's clearly not the right thing to do. If someone wants to be a knob, you should just let them get on with it. But it is frustrating. But the trouble is, by doing it, and they take your gap to the car in front. They cut it in half, don't they?
Yes.
So suddenly they put you in a dangerous position.
Exactly, and then you have to slow down to create the gap, and you have rewarded their terrible behaviour. But to me, I'm afraid it's an awful thing to say. I mean, because I used to be you. When I was your age, I was you. I'd close the gap. Because I would just, because in my mind, I would think, haha, if I do this, then he'll learn his lesson and he won't do it again.
No, yeah, which is
cobblers. And B, even if he doesn't, there are so many millions of others just like him who will. It's a completely futile gesture. Mm. So now I will almost always let him get away with it. Which is awful, but it's not awful actually. I think it's the right thing to do, but I really don't like it. But I think it is. I mean, I just try to think to myself, not what is the morally correct thing to do here, which is questionably close the gap, but what is the safe thing to do, which I'm afraid is to let him go away with it and to indulge his appalling behaviour and let him go and do it to somebody else. It's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah. But safety should come first. It really should. But the thing about lane discipline on the motorway is that, you know, when particularly a busy motorway, if you observe proper lane discipline, you just get boxed in endlessly and you don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
If you're the only one pulling left every time, pulling left, you just get someone sitting on the outside of you, maybe in your blind spot. You can't get out. You find yourself boxed in behind a lorry. And it doesn't work if you're the only one doing it, which is massively frustrating.
No. And usually you are. And so, you know, again, the way things are configured, or the way, I don't know what it is, but, you know, it rewards bad behaviour, doesn't it?
This still strikes me as utterly, utterly mad, but there is no motorway element on the driving test or any need for your driving instructor to show you a motorway before you take your test.
We've done this before, haven't we? There is no requirement to drive in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, as well as anybody who's ever driven it, you know that driving in the dark is a completely different thing to driving, requiring a different skill set, and it's, you know, and it's scary. I mean, you know, my children, who, you know, one of whom's been driving for 5 years, one has been driving for 2 years. You know, one of them is still doesn't like driving in the dark. And will do it if she has to, but we'll, you know, we'd try quite hard not to for exactly that. And I think that if she had gone out with, I mean, I did when I was teaching her, you know, we would go out in the dark, and we would go out in the rest. Another thing, I mean, you can't guarantee the weather when you learn to drive, but there will be wet day. You know, there's no requirement for you to have ever driven on a wet road before, and to understand about braking distances and everything else. Yeah, and I think that the test is not fit for purpose, and I thought this for a, for a very long time. But you're right. You know, the very fact that you have never driven onto a motorway, you have never had that. You could probably still remember the first time you had to drive down a slip road onto a fast moving, busy motorway in your, you know, in your little shitbox, because that's what everyone drives when they're 17. It's scary, isn't it? And you can see the end of the slip lane coming. And there's a lorry there, and he's not going anywhere. And do you try to out accelerate it and get in front of it, or do you just slam on the brakes and go in behind it? But there's someone already behind you trying to do the same, and it's just like
Yeah, you know, it's massively daunting for particularly for a young nervous driver. It really is,
absolutely, yeah.
And but they what apart from educating themselves, which clearly is what everyone should do, but it's not likely to happen. How on earth are these people supposed to understand how motorways are supposed to function? You know, no one's told them.
Well, probably. They've read it in the Highway Code, haven't they? You know, but reading isn't doing, is it? And motorways have, you know, I like to think of myself, I'm clearly not, but I like to think of myself as being a sort of a great, what's the word? I have a great interest in the language of other road users. And I like looking at other cars and the way they address the road. And there is so much you can learn about how a car is being driven. You know, it doesn't have to be weaving around doing anything stupid. You can just look at the positioning. You can tell whether I can always tell when someone's on their telephone. I can always tell the slightly distracted driver. You know, and whether they keep slightly to the left or the right of their lane, you know, their distance, and whether they're hovering. And you can tell if someone's going to try to overtake the car in front long before they've moved out, before they've indicated or anything else, because of the way their car moves relative to the thing, you know. And you just learn all this stuff, which you can't teach. But if you'd been out and had to have a number of hours on a motorway before you took your test, you'd have seen all this. You might have learned it all by rote, but you would have so much better an understanding of it than literally just, you know, looking in the Highway Code and knowing the speed limit 70 miles an hour on a motorway. Well, you know.
That's about most people's understanding, isn't it? That's the extent of it. What about when, you know, when you've got the cruise control on, it's not too busy, so you're quite happy just sticking to your speed, you have a car that comes past you, and then it slows down, so you have to go past it, and then it comes past you again, and you keep doing, you're not changing your speed at all, but you keep going past them, and they come past you. It's annoying, isn't it? You just know that
absolutely,
they're all over the place.
It's absolutely bloody infuriating. The thing, I call these people limpets.
Yeah.
What will usually happen is it's usually, I find it happens most sort of very early in the morning on summer days. So it's light. It happens in the dark as well. But basically, someone comes along and no one's going very fast. And you're spinballing on the motorway at, you know, 70 something miles an hour. And someone just appears on your tail. And they're a bit too close. Nothing else on the motorway. And so you think, well, that's a bit annoying because they're driving a bit too close. And so you think, well, what do I do about that? So I think, well, okay, so I'll slow down a little bit because that'll encourage them to overtake me. And they slow down too. And then you slow down a bit more and they slow down a bit more. And you thought, okay, fine. Well, they clearly don't want to overtake me, so I'll increase the gap. So I'll speed up a bit. And they speed up a bit. And whatever you do, and I've done this with people. I have, you know, and I do it with cruise control where you can reduce your speed by a single mile per hour each time. Mm. You know, you can have 20-mile-an-hour increments, 10 down, 10 up, and they just stay there. And you start to get paranoid, and you think, oh, they're stalking me. But they're not. They're just using you as their own cruise control. As long as they can see you,
yeah,
they don't have to think about anything else.
Well, that's it. You realise you're thinking for them.
you're thinking for them. And they're not doing it actively. They're not trying to wind you up. They're just not thinking. And, you know, and they just automatically, because they drive so much, they just, you know, they just think, well, I'm behind that car now, so I'm going to stay behind that car. You know, the fact that car is now doing 20 miles an hour less than it was doing 5 minutes ago, literally doesn't occur to them. And so, you know, what I have done to get rid of limp is, this is ridiculous, is, but, you know, I've come up to a junction and I've gone off the motorway over the roundabout at the top and straight back on again.
Back on.
Because even if you do, even if you, for instance, you just give it the beans, yeah. And disappear, they'll catch you up and they'll do it again.
Yeah, they will.
And even if you do the reverse and you slow down so much that they have to overtake you, and you slow down, you give them all the space, and all, sooner or later, when you get back up to whatever speed you're doing, you'll find them again. It's bizarre. They're like magnets. They just find you. And it, God, it just winds me up. And if they just stayed a sense, you know, they're really sort of really, you know, dangerous tailgating. They're just a bit too close. So you've got this big motorway. There's nothing on it apart from one other idiot who's just 10 yards closer than they should be. Okay, here's another thing, which is related, which I'm gonna, why I'm going to mention it. And if anybody listening to this drives an interesting car, you will know this person. This is the person who sees your interesting car and comes up behind your interesting car. Much too close, because they don't have a zoom lens on their iPhone. So the only way they're going to get a decent photograph of you in your interesting car is to drive on your bumper. But of course, that means that they only get the rear shot. So the next thing that happens is they think, oh, I better come alongside. And so they're driving along with one hand, looking out the side window with their telephone, photographing the side of your car. And then they think, well, we better get a front view too. So they go in front of you and then slow down. You must have come across these people, Dan. You must have done.
Yeah. I remember being in a Huracan, Lamborghini Huracan, when it was brand new, one of the first on the road in the UK. And honestly, the number of people in cars and vans coming up alongside you or up behind you with their phones out was frightening. And you just realise you're surrounded by people who are not paying attention to what they're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And if there's going to be an accident, you're going to be part of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The worst one I had for that was, I'm guessing 5 years ago, I had a BMW i8 long-termer. Fabulous car. I wanted a podcast about i8s and i3s, but that's another subject for another time. And the attention that got was just ridiculous. And I only realised how much attention it got, really, when I chopped it in for a 911 and became completely anonymous. Nobody paid me any attention at all. And I love that about it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about a 911. It's just about anonymous enough.
Given it's just another car, isn't it?
An expensive
car. Yeah.
That's why they're brilliant. The whole thing, I think we've said this before, but the first and most important step anybody can take towards being a better driver is taking pride in their driving, wanting to be a better driver. And that separates you from probably 80, 90% of people on the road, because for the vast majority of people, driving is just a menial task. It doesn't occur to them that you can be good or bad at driving, no more than it occurs to them that you can be good or bad at doing the washing up. They just consider it something that they have to do. Well, actually, my other half is as well. So yes, you can be bad at washing up.
Is your other half a dishwasher Nazi? I am married to a dishwasher Nazi. I cannot load a dishwasher without her rearranging it.
I think I'm the Nazi.
Oh, are you?
I think so, yeah.
Actually, no, you would be, wouldn't you? You would be. And does your washing up get scrutinised? Mine does.
No, I think
because
I'm
we don't put the.
I'm the opposite of you.
Oh, so you're the scrutiniser?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Also, in our house, it's not possible to load a dishwasher without endlessly shouting at the dog and telling him to get away.
Get his head out. Yes, we have that. Yes, good, excellent. So how do we get from driving standards to dishwasher Nazis?
Well, the point I was making is that most people don't care whether they're a good driver or a bad driver, because it doesn't occur to them that you can be either of those things.
No, it's just driving, isn't it? It's just something they don't want to do. They accept they have to do it, and, you know, they've passed a test, and therefore they have to be able to do it. And that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I do if I'm on a very, very long journey, it shows how sad I am, but I will often just really focus on seeing how well I can drive a car, because, you know, you don't have to be, you know, on a racetrack or on a mountain road to drive a car well. You know, there's a big difference between driving a car adequately, safely, and actually driving it well, even just on a motorway. And I think it's just a sort of, you know, good bit of due diligence just to every so often just stop thinking about, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, you're thinking about what you're going to have for dinner when you get home, or, you know, when you next go to the pub, and actually just think about your driving. How are you positioned on the road? Are you in the right lane? Are you doing the right speed for the conditions? You know, have you anticipated everything else? You know, have a look around yourself. Just try and anticipate stuff. Don't have to react to stuff. You know, act before it happens. And yeah, I find myself doing that quite a lot. But then again, I'm a sad middle-aged bloke.
Well, it's good discipline, though, isn't it? And you're right about anticipation. That's the, if you're looking far enough ahead of you down the road and just monitoring what's going on, you can always be in the right lane, never have to jump on the brakes or accelerate hard to escape a situation. Although it becomes much, much more challenging when the road is very busy and you've got people just jostling for position around you. Then it becomes a bit of a scrap, doesn't it? So what have you observed on the road, specific incidents that have shocked you or surprised you or made you think, wow?
This isn't specific, but it's a specific set of circumstances. And it's one of the things that I see most often and which I'm sure causes untold numbers of accidents, which is drivers of large SUVs thinking the weather doesn't apply to them because they're in a large SUV. And you're sitting there and, you know, whatever you're in, you know, you can feel the car skipping off the puddles and you can see the bits of the motorway are flooded and you got your speed right down. And then somebody, you know, lights blazing, comes steaming up in some massive 7-seat barge, and you just know what they're thinking. They're thinking it's got four-wheel drive. It's a four-wheel drive. It's an SUV. This is what it's designed for. But it's not.
No.
You know, what they don't know, what they don't understand, is that all four-wheel drive does is allow, is improve the speed at which you can gain. It's a traction device. It allows you to gain speed faster on compromised surfaces. Doesn't help you stop.
No.
At all.
No.
You know, and if you've got some big, high, heavy SUV, actually, that's going to be a lot harder to stop because it's momentum. It's physics, you know, and you know, compared to some small light thing, you know, there's a lot more momentum going. And you see these blokes charging along. Again, yes, they are all blokes. And, you know, it just...
And particularly in a high-performance SUV, and we have very recent experience of this, don't we? A high-performance SUV might wear quite compromised tyres, quite focused sporting tyres, and so actually not be properly suited to standing water.
Well, we can say, can't we? We're talking about a Porsche Cayenne Turbo GT, which came on Pirelli Corsas, which is that is a sort of hybrid road track day tyre.
Yeah.
With a very shallow tread pattern. And I just don't know whether people who, you know, have those cars, you know, think hard enough about exactly what's connecting them to the road and the physics of, you know, 2.2 tons of car doing 85 miles an hour, you know, with vast amounts of water. And, you know, and obviously the increased risk of, you know, something happening or them having to come to a halt in a hell of a hurry. And that really gives me the heebie-jeebies. The other thing that also scare, genuinely scares me is fog.
Oh, it's awful.
It's awful. And, you know, I drive incredibly slowly in fog. You know, I've been known to give up journeys because, you know, I've seen forecasts and I can see what it's on. I just think this isn't safe. And, you know, there will still be someone. And again, I think, and usually actually, God, I'm resorting to generalities here, but my perception is that it tends to be working vehicles, so like vans and that sort of thing. And again, I think it probably comes down to people with deadlines, people trying to, you know, not miss time slots.
Earn a living.
Yeah, earn a living, exactly, because of the pressure their employer puts them under. Just steaming on and a kind of hope it'll be kind of all right. Yeah, no, it just frightens the hell out of me. I mean, yeah, there are times on a motorway in thick fog where 30 miles an hour is terrifyingly fast.
Yeah.
And we've all been in them. And some people just sort of seem to think, oh, it'll be all right. Mm. Nothing in front of me.
And you're worried about someone coming up behind you, aren't you?
Oh, if you go too goodness, slow. Yes. Yeah. So
is that more or less dangerous than driving when you're absolutely bursting for a wee?
No, I think it's much more dangerous because when you're driving, you're absolutely bursting for a wee. You know, you're going to be paying attention, aren't you?
Yeah, but it changes your driving, doesn't it? Oh, dear. Okay, well, what's the most skillful piece of driving you recall seeing on the road?
I saw someone avoid an accident. And it was one of those things where we were, I'm just trying to remember, it was a long time ago, but we're going down, I think we were on the M4, and there had been, it wasn't a big pile-up, but two or three cars had got together, and I was far enough back, so I wasn't going to be involved in it. But there was a chap in, it was something like a Vauxhall Calibra, sort of slightly sporting coupe. And I can remember thinking to myself, because I was hard on the brakes, thinking I'm going to be okay. And, you know, you're doing that bit where you're actually just checking in the mirror to make sure that somebody isn't going to come piling in the back of you. But I was aware of this plan. I thought, you're going to be in a spot of bother here, mate. And he just did this unbelievable avoid, because all the things were still having the accident at the time. They were still pinging off each other. And he went right across all the carriageways and nipped round them on the hard shoulder and kept going. And I just thought that was...
bloody hell.
I mean, what you could argue is that he should never have been that close to it, because in the old sort of stopping what you can see thing. But, you know, I hadn't switched on to it soon enough to know whether that was the case. All I saw was the avoid. And that was really very impressive. Mm.
I shouldn't.
Yeah. What about you?
I shouldn't celebrate this, and it is naughty, but we were young. and, yeah. I would never do this stuff today, but you know, when you're 17 and you and your mates have just started driving, you do some silly things, don't you? At night, one evening, well, we had this road near us where a bunch of us lived, that didn't seem to go anywhere. It didn't really connect anything to anything else. And unlike all the other lanes around us, this one was completely open. There were no hedgerows, so you could see all the way along it. And so it's like a little rally stage or something, and we used to time ourselves along it, and I had a 1.6 litre Focus with 100 horsepower, and
very
my
good.
Other mate had a 1.2 litre Clio with a lot less power, and so I thought, well, I've got 100 horsepower, he cannot possibly beat me, and it was probably a third of a mile that way, and then you stop, turn around, and a third of a mile back the other way. And you'd have someone next to you timing you. And I would, you know, accelerate quickly. And it was a wiggly little road. And there were two sort of not quite 90 degree corners going the same direction, but, you know, quite speedy, but definite corners. And I would brake for that and turn in, you know, what I thought was quickly and accelerate away again. And actually, in hindsight, I wasn't driving very quickly at all. And so I set my time, and I thought, 100 horsepower, there's no chance he's going to beat me. What I didn't appreciate was that my mate in his Clio was, at the time, a very promising rally driver. And I knew he was.
You're talking about.
Yeah, you do. And I just thought, well, it doesn't matter. I've got 100 horsepower. And I was watching him come back through the stage. It wasn't the stage. And I was sort of on a grass bank, so I could see most of it. And I saw him come up to these two right-handers coming back that way. And he approached the first one even before he got to the turning point. He was sideways in his little Clio. And he flashed through this corner, disappeared behind a tree or an earth bank or something. And I thought, he's had a massive crash. I've just witnessed my mate have an enormous crash. And then he approached the next corner in exactly the same attitude, came through that, didn't leave the road at all. He was always under total control of his car, and he came across the line, and he was literally in each direction 5 seconds faster than I'd been. over in your 100 horsepower third of Focus. A mile. It was the most humbling thing.
That's got to smart a bit.
It really did. I could not believe it. Well, it was extremely eye-opening, and it made me realise the difference between a sort of enthusiastic driver and a really massively skillful one. Just the level of ability and commitment and speed was well beyond anything I could have imagined. It was extraordinary to witness. We don't do it anymore. This was a long time ago.
So what is the worst piece of driving that you have witnessed from a passenger seat without there actually being an accident?
I think I've spoken about this on the podcast before, but I was a passenger on a launch, Mazda MX-5 launch, and the chap driving just misjudged, was going too quickly, misjudged a corner. Didn't spot that there was a big compression in the middle of it. Road was greasy, we were going properly quick, and the car just stepped out. Massive stability control intervention one way, massive intervention the other way, and only because the systems were good, we stayed on the road.
So without the systems, enormous accident.
Off into the trees at speed, yeah. Horrendous.
I might have spoken about this on the podcast before, but if I did, it's probably more than 100 episodes ago. So hopefully, if anybody has heard the story, it wouldn't have been for a couple of years. The Ford Street Car. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
The convertible car, as launched by Kylie Minogue. They launched it in the south of France, and as I always do with any car launch, I rang up the manufacturer in advance and said, "Who's going?" Because you want me to team up with someone, and I want to make sure that I don't have to share a car with an idiot. And they went, "Well, this is the list of people that are going, but actually, it's an odd number of people, so we've got one car which doesn't need to have two people in it." So you can have that if you like. Whoopee. Yeah? Have a car for myself. Fantastic. Bingo. So I turn up on the South Front very happy. And they're doing the car allocation. And the Ford PR man comes up to me and goes, "Oh, yeah, a slight change of plan. There was an American journalist who was meant to turn up on the previous wave, but he missed his plane, so he's here now. So would you mind sharing with him?" Oh, joy. So I don't think, well, fair enough. So you know, in those circumstances, if I'm driving with someone I haven't driven before and I don't know, I just drive like Miss Daisy on the chauffeur's day off. Okay, so I get in the car, I drive the car first, and I just show how I think is, you know, I would like the car to be in the hope that he gets the hint. And so we got to the coffee shop, where, as you know, where you change drivers. And I knew I was in trouble when he reached into his rucksack that he had with him and pulled out his Ferrari baseball cap and then put it on his head the wrong way around.
Here we go.
And he then just drove down. I think we were on the Col de Vence. And he just drove like a complete idiot. Not just way too fast, but so clearly lacking any kind of road sense at all. You're sitting there thinking, how can this bloke earn a living out of, you know, driving cars and writing about them? And you get that, and you would have had this with, you know, people you shared cars, and you could suddenly, you know, you come up against another car and you think, oh, thank goodness, you know, we're going to be held up.
And
you just think, well, you know, you can't overtake down here. There's just not. And anyway, so he decided that he was going to overtake this thing. Because a short straight had opened up. What he hadn't seen was coming up the short, and it's quite remarkable that he hadn't seen this, but he hadn't. Coming up the short straight towards us was a peloton of cyclists. There must have been about 30 cyclists coming up here. And I was just thinking, well, he's going to bail out. He has to bail out. I mean, you know, he is going to drive into 30 cyclists unless he bails out, and he didn't bail out. And the only thing which just stopped an utter catastrophe happening was there was just one of those, you know, those big sort of rough lay-by gravelly areas at the side of the road. And all the cyclists just piled onto that. I mean, they must have been, because, you know, if you're at the back of that peloton, you must have just sort of seen something happen and just reacted with everybody else. And so they all threw themselves onto this and he went past. I mean, it was just the most, I don't even imagine what could have happened if they hadn't done that. But he wasn't going to lift. He was going past come what may. And I think what happened was that he just realised that he'd made such a tit of himself that he just thought, I've got to see this through to prove that I was right in doing this. And do you know what the worst thing about it all was? I didn't mention it.
Yeah.
I didn't say anything.
That's your British reserve, isn't it?
At the bottom of the hill. And what I should have said was just, you know, either I'm driving or I'm getting out. You choose. And I would have just, I don't even know, I would have had a mobile then. I probably would. I wouldn't have cared. You know, it was just, I mean, I think he did realise that he'd cocked up massively, because I don't remember any further incidents or any after that. But, you know, he could have killed people.
Absolutely. The ridiculous thing is, to us Brits, it seems impolite to say something, doesn't it? Which is
I was almost as angry with myself as I was with him for not saying anything. It was pathetic.
Yeah.
I should have. I should have. You know, torn him a new one. I really should, but I didn't. I just sat there thinking, "Oh God, please let this be over."
That's not good. anything else you want to say about road etiquette?
Well, I mean, where do you want to start? Parking. Can we do parking?
Okay.
Parking. You know, people who park. You know, so you have parked in your space in the supermarket, and we know that in car parks and supermarkets, the space is provided where they're all designed for when cars are a lot smaller than they are now. So you park right in the middle of your space, because in the middle of a space is the only way you can park while being considerate to the people who park to your left and your right. And then someone just comes and parks on your right hand side, because they only have to get out of their right hand door, which means you can't get in. You literally can't get into your car. I mean, this actually happened to me at Silverstone once, actually in the I-8. I don't know what I was doing there, but I was at Silverstone. And because the I-8 has those dihedral doors, if someone parks too close to you, you literally can't get in the car. It's not a question of, you know, it being a bit awkward or a bit uncomfortable, a bit painful. You know, you literally can't get in the car. So what I'd done was, there was this big parking area, and I think it was on the outside of Copps or somewhere. But anyway, so, you know, and there was a car to the left of me, absolutely fine, doesn't matter at all. And to the right, there was a big hatched yellow area saying no parking here. So I thought, fantastic, perfect. I'll just park in this space and no one can park next to me. And I got back at the end of the day and somebody had.
Yeah, that's annoying.
So I got him towed.
Did you?
Yeah.
How did you manage
absolutely.
That?
I had a chat with someone, and they had a chat with someone, and we got him towed. So he would have come back in his car.
Yeah, there you go. What's so frustrating is when you're trying to look after your car, so you park well out of the way, and then someone parks right next to you. There's nothing else around, loads of other spaces.
Yeah, but it's happened,
isn't
it?
And he parks right next to you.
Oh. Yes. Okay. People who... We always say these. I shouldn't laugh because it's unbelievably dangerous. But, you know, people on really cold days when there's lots of frost on the car, and they just rub away a little sort of keyhole in the windscreen and think that because they can see the road in front of them, that somehow makes them safe. And you see these people in these completely frosted up cars. That winds me up.
It is frustrating sitting there waiting for the fans to do anything, because they can take bloody ages when it's really iced up. But that's purely because... And you're thinking, I'm going to be late. But that's entirely your fault for not leaving enough time.
Yes, and they have these things called scrapers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Use it.
It doesn't take long to scrape, you know, a bit of your... You know, because what you do is you start your engine and you get your heated rear window on. And then you start going around the rest of it, and you find that even in the time it takes you to clear your windscreen, then you know the sides are starting to defrost, and you know, and it doesn't take that long.
Mm. Mm. If the car's fogged up, it can take longer because you don't want to wipe it, do you?
No,
but that's a very good one. Have you got more?
Well, I think driving. Yeah, okay. I mean, this is the big one, and this is a really. What's the word? Not controversial. It's a very sensitive issue. Driving too slow.
Hmm. Oh God. Yeah, we had one recently here actually, and it's dangerous and it's massively infuriating. You know, when people are literally doing on a 60 road, 60 mile an hour country lane, 25 miles an hour with a queue of traffic behind them.
Yeah, and it makes. Jasper Carrot once did a sketch about, well, I think it might have even been a mother-in-law joke, for which, you know, it doesn't matter who it was, but he did this sketch about somebody who I've been driving for 50 years and never had an accident, but seen thousands. And that's it. That's what happens, isn't it? People drive along at... And we have talked about this on the podcast before, but as you say, they're on a big A road, but it's winding. And, you know, and again, that road that goes near where we live, it's exactly like that. It's a winding road. The speed limit is 60 miles an hour. I don't mind if people are doing 50. Yeah. That's absolutely fine. But if people are doing 28, it is frustrating. And you can see other road users getting angry. And what infuriates me most about it is what happens is they're doing 28 and they suddenly get into a village and somehow that makes them feel sort of safe and secure. So they speed up. Most of the villages around here, because most of the villages around here are in Wales, are now 20 mile an hour limits. And so you get to the point where they're absolutely nowhere, they're less than half the speed limit in open countryside when you can go quite quick. And then you get into a built up area and they're suddenly breaking the speed limit by 20-30%. It's what they make. You cannot condone, dangerous overtaking, whatever speed, the car at the front of the queue has been doing for however long they've been doing it. But, we wouldn't be human if you weren't tempted and you didn't feel that frustration and you weren't wound up by it. And although you don't agree with people who do it, and you would never say that the subsequent accident was anything else than their fault, you do understand why it happens, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You do.
So do you think there should be a requirement to be able to drive in clear conditions on an open road at, 80% of the speed limit? I mean, it'd be impossible to police. You couldn't start prosecuting people for driving too slowly. Or maybe you can. I think it actually is. Is it an offence in the Highway Code to be driving too slowly?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. But this is... You're right. It is a sensitive issue. It's a tricky one. But...
Well, it is. Sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to say, you and I are going to do a test soon. I'm not going to give it away, but one of the cars won't do more than 30 miles an hour.
Oh, yes, that test. Yes. Yes, it's going to be a fun one. There is true. But at the same time, if you say that you have to be able to drive down an A road at 50 miles an hour, what you will be saying to an awful lot of people is you can't drive a car anymore.
That's true.
Because they don't feel safe doing that. And these are usually, elderly people. And, who are we to say you shouldn't be on the road anymore? I don't know. It's a really contentious is the word I was looking for. It's a really contentious issue. And I don't think that there are any right answers. But I suspect it comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning in context of cyclists. There just needs to be more understanding, doesn't there? And more patience. But it also cuts both ways. It happens to me a little bit when I'm out in my 2CV, which really isn't a very fast car. And if I'm going up a steep hill in it, it's an unbelievably slow car. You may be about to find this out. There are hills around here. It won't do 20 miles an hour up. And if I find myself, I try to avoid them, to be honest, but, sometimes I can't. And if I find myself in that situation and I see three or four cars behind me, all I'm doing is looking for somewhere to pull over. Hate the idea of holding people up. I hate the idea of all those people hating me and of all the things I'm making them late for. And I suspect that a lot of it's in my mind because I think most people are sitting there thinking, oh, that's a nice old car. We'll be at the top of the hill soon. It doesn't matter. But to me, I'm just thinking, I'm causing the problem here. What can I do to stop it? But
yeah. And you just feel pressure, don't you? And the eyeballs on the back of your neck. I can understand that. Yeah. Driving etiquette. Well, that was a bit of a rant, wasn't it?
What?
I'm sure we missed a few things that wind people up, but it'd be interesting to hear you all, hear what you all think. Let us know on Instagram or Twitter or anything. It'd be fun to hear from you. We've got a listener question coming up in a moment. Before that, let me just remind you all to rate and review the podcast. It's really important. You do it. So thank you, everybody, to everybody who's done it so far. If you haven't rated and reviewed the podcast yet, why not do it now? It really helps. The listener question is from Thomas R. And this is about our industry. He says, lots of the car magazines I used to enjoy reading have disappeared. Enzo, Vantage, Modern Classics, Private Motor Club and others. What's going on? And are others in peril?
Yes. Okay, what's going on is that advertising has fallen off a cliff. You know, magazines, to be, if I'm honest with you, the magazine business has been in trouble since, you know, the original, well, not the original slump, but since the last big slump in 2007, 2008. And things have not really recovered because, you know, there's been the double hit of advertising revenues falling through the floor and also the migration to online. And, you know, there are people who will tell you that it's a dying business. And, you know, there isn't a magazine that I work for that's, you know, isn't feeling the pinch, some more than others. And as Thomas R. says, you know, all those magazines, the BMW magazine is gone. The Porsche magazine I used to write for is gone. So many of them are gone. And so, yes, I think you'd be naive to think that somehow all of the others that are still clinging on are absolutely fine. I suspect they're probably not. And it's really, really very difficult. And, you know, it's two things arising from this. It's one reason we, our business, the TI business, the web and the app side, the website and the app, don't have an advertising model attached to them, because we know how vulnerable that makes the business. And also because you end up writing what they want you to write rather than what you want to write. And I've completely forgotten what the second thing was. Good. That went well, didn't it?
Well, that's fine. I mean, you're right. Magazines are, I think, having a tough time of it. I suppose if you want them to hang around, you've got to go out and buy them. So what I hope is that it's not motoring journalism that's in peril, but just a form of motoring journalism. And I hope that in the future there are other ways that our vocation can flourish, whether it's different media like this, like YouTube, digital publishing. I just hope that there is a future and a bright future for what we do, even if the printed form has a tough time.
And I think that, you know, it's like people always said that, you know, vinyl was dead when compact discs came along, and that, you know, film was dead when TV came along. You know, what tends to happen is that they tend to find a way, don't they? And they come back, well, in film's case, bigger and better than ever. But even in vinyl's case, you know, the vinyl industry is nothing like it was, but it is a thriving niche business now. And I suspect that that is what will happen. I think that there will be, you know, I'm interested in the fortunes of these, you know, these big quarterly glossy magazines like Magneto and Road Rat, which have very high production values, very expensive to buy. But I suspect, and I don't know, that's the long-term future for those sorts of things. They'll probably be subscription only, so you won't find them in newsagents, because, you know, the cost of distribution is so great. But who knows? It is, you know, it is, if you look at the readerships of, you know, every magazine, certainly that I've ever contributed to in however long I've been doing this, compared to what it was like in the late 1980s when I started, it's, you know, frankly, the surprise is that there are as many still around today that there as there are, because if you actually looked at the numbers, you think, well, how could you possibly survive? I think what happens is the way they survive is they make money from their websites, and the magazines are increasingly loss leaders for them. I don't know, but yeah, no, the situation is bad. I cannot see it getting any better, particularly as we move into recession. And, you know, and I love this business. I've been proud to write for so many really, really great magazines. I hope they all survive. I really, really do. And not just because, you know, I still earn a bit of my living from them, but because I think car magazines are great things. If you could look around this office, you'll find, you know, not here, that's books, but that way is just walls of magazines, which I love and I cherish. And, you know, I hope to continue, you know, filling up for years to come.
Yeah, indeed. Thomas, thank you for your question. Get your questions across, and we'll end next week's podcast with another.
Thank you. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.